From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very, very good afternoon to you. It's Kate Turkington. You're traveling with Kate, 12 noon on Sunday. And a big, big treat for you this week, because a bit later in the program, I'm going to be talking to South Africa's most famous, globally famous astronomer about stars, about the James Webb Telescope. How are we all made of stardust? What's our little tiny galaxy, which is smaller than a grain of sand, about? And Prof Block, David Block, he puts it in terms that we can all understand so, so well. And I have recommended to you earlier on Netflix, there's a documentary called Unknown about the James Webb Telescope. Don't think it's dry, it's dusty, it's going to confuse with you with science, confuse science and you, confuse all of us. It will have you on the edge of your seat. My whole family has watched it. I think all my friends watched it, Unknown, and it explains so much so easily. Okay, and then a real creed occur from the Two Oceans Aquarium, particularly for you who are listening in Cape Town, because apparently it's the Western leopard toad breeding season. I don't know if you even knew there was such a thing as a Western leopard toad. It's a gorgeous little creature. And remember, toads are frogs and frogs are toads. So there's a slight difference, but basically frogs are frogs and toads are toads and toads are frogs and frogs are toads. Okay, they're very, very good for your garden. If you see a lovely little coloured sort of leopard-spotted toad frog in your garden, leave him there, leave her there. They eat insects, they eat snails, they eat slugs. They're the most wonderful thing for your garden. But at the moment, apparently, it's breeding season, and they are moving from their homes to their breeding places. And what's happening? They're crossing your roads in the Cape. And please, please drive carefully. If you see something that looks like a brown stone in the middle of the road, obviously, if you can stop or carefully swerve round it, do, because it's a really perilous time for these toads, and they're unique to South Africa. You don't find them anywhere else in the world. So particularly around the Cape Peninsula, large, large numbers of these toads are crossing the road. So if you are driving at night, do try and keep an eye open for them. Very, very special, endemic to the Western Cape. I didn't even know such a thing existed. We, of course, have bullfrogs up here in Gauteng, which have teeth and are the size of footballs. Huge, huge things. But one thing, another useless piece of wildlife general knowledge for you, the male bullfrog is so caring and careful of his tadpoles. When eventually the tadpoles hatch from the frog spawn, he will carry them in his mouth to the nearest source of water. He'll actually dig a tunnel. If you've got one in your garden or nearby, he'll dig a tunnel under the ground, collect all his little babies up, and take them off to a safe spot. Phew. Nature is wonderful. And a bit later on when we talk to David Block, you're going to find out how wonderful our cosmos is too. And just a few words about Kerala in India. You know, and I've said to you, I'll nail my colours to the mast. India is my own personal favourite destination. I love India. And Kerala is down there. You've probably heard of Kerala because it's one of India's most sought-after holiday destinations. It's down there on the southwest coast, and it's got over 600 kilometres of shoreline. It's actually the Arabian Sea down there, and it's known as the Malabar coast. And this is an interesting thing. Kerala is the most advanced state in India, a most advanced society. Listen to this. It's a big state. It's got 100% literacy. 100% literacy. The highest life expectancy rates in India and the lowest infant mortality rates. And one thing about Kerala, for years and years and centuries, people and religions have coexisted happily together. So you've got Hindus, you've got Muslims, you've got Christians, and of course you've got Jews in Kerala. It's believed that Jews first came there about AD, late 60s, I think, when the Roman Empire was still going. And of course, many apparently went to India after the Roman attack on the tabernacle in Jerusalem. And then there was another big second wave of Jews in the 16th century. They were the ones who were escaping the Portuguese and Spanish inquisitions. And there's a very, very famous synagogue. I don't know if it's one of the oldest in the world. It's certainly a very, very old synagogue. I've actually been there in Kerala, 1568. That's a very, very old synagogue. Today, I think there's only a handful of Jews left in Kerala. And many, of course, were taken to Israel after partition when India became independent. But beautiful, beautiful synagogue there in Kerala. Lovely, lovely place to go if you're thinking of going to India. Very, very safe, wonderful shopping. Ayurveda, if you're on a health kick, that's the Sanskrit word, by the way. It's the study of prolonging life. You've all read about Ayurvedic treatments and whatever. But there are Ayurvedic physicians, there are Ayurvedic treatments of all kind. Also, there's a wonderful wildlife reserve in the Western Ghat mountain ranges. There's a tiger reserve called Periyar Tiger Reserve. And then, of course, you've got all the active stuff. You can do elephant rides, bamboo rafting. You can also take a cooking course. When I went to Kerala, one of my friends did a one-day cooking course there. She is a cook. And what we did, which was absolutely gorgeous with a group of friends, we cruised on a traditional houseboat. So these houseboats are made of wood and bamboo, handcrafted, no nails are used in the construction at all. And they just cruise through the scenic backwaters. Absolutely beautiful, quiet, peaceful. So, you know, maybe you've been to Rajasthan, maybe you've been to the Taj Mahal, maybe you've been to northern India, maybe you haven't been to India at all. But Kerala, down there in the southwest of India, is a lovely, lovely place to visit. You'll be enchanted by it.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
Professor David Block is an astronomer, sought-after speaker on matters relating to astronomy, as well as the science-faith dichotomy. I mean, he's devoted over 40 years to encouraging audiences all around the globe, always to look up. And I too remember the very first time I interviewed Prof Block, which is donkey's years ago. I've never forgotten. I say it to my children and my grandchildren now. We're all made of stardust, Kate.
Yes.
But more of that. Okay, the list, I mean, your research papers, your honorary degrees, your, we'd be here all day, David, if I was to go through those. And of course, when I first knew you, you were a prof at Wits in the School of Computer Science and Applied Mathematics. So a very, very hearty welcome to you.
Oh, it's just awesome to be with you, Kate. And it just brings back the most glorious memories of being interviewed by you on radio many, many, many times.
Indeed. Now, it's so difficult for lay people to understand not only our own universe, but also the infinite world beyond. Can you help us here with an analogy of some kind?
Yes. Well, of course, Kate, we live in our galaxy called the Milky Way Galaxy. And so the solar system is in our Milky Way Galaxy. And the Milky Way Galaxy is one of billions of galaxies. A galaxy generally consists of around 1 million stars. You know, if you had to count one star per second in our Milky Way Galaxy alone, one would be seated or standing, counting for 2,500 years, counting a second just in our galaxy. And there's not just our galaxy, but then you've got the Andromeda Galaxy, you've got the large and the small Magellanic Clouds. When you go out, as you often do, say at the Okavango or elsewhere, and you look up, and you see those two Magellanic Clouds, those are other galaxies. So the universe is filled not only with stars, but the building blocks of our universe, Kate, are galaxies. And what's been so amazing over the many years in which I've been a professor and speaking about astronomy and so on is that, you know, now we have the James Webb Space Telescope. It's absolutely awesome. It was launched on Christmas Day, 2021, and it's sending back the most incredible images of the birthing, and I want to talk to you this later, the actual birth of our Big Bang universe. That to me is, it's another dimension, if you like, Kate, sort of cosmological gynecology, if you like, the very birthing of our universe. But, you know, Kate, as I look up at the night sky, I've always been filled with tremendous, a sense of awe, a sense of wonder, a sense of purpose. And even though I am a prof, a sense of one's knowledge is just but a grain of sand on the beach, you know. I think it was Einstein who said that. And I look back over all these years of academic training and, you know, all these years and speaking at Harvard and elsewhere. And I realize that my knowledge, too, is yet but one little grain of sand on the beach. And I think that it gives one a tremendous sense, you know, Kate, of humility in that there's no arrogance in the cosmos. That's what I love about it. Is that it enables us with the greatest degrees of load shedding to always look up and to be filled with things that are priceless, that are jewels, and they cost no money. I think that's one of the most incredible things, is it not, Kate?
Yes.
Is that the universe, views of the universe are free to all. And, you know, to the sand in Namibia or elsewhere, thousands of years ago, they could look up and see the glories of the night sky, and it's free, and it fills me with a sense of grandeur and splendor and marvel and awe.
I remember again many moons ago sitting with Sam Bushman in the Kalahari. And it's a long story. I won't bore you with it. But what I do remember, the chief or the chieftain of the group said, I want you to be quiet. I want you to hear the stars sing.
Well,
Every time I go to the bush, I go quiet or get whomsoever I'm with to be quiet. Yes, and we sit and we listen to the stars sing, the music of the universe.
And you know, Kate, I have asked people around the world, when last have you actually seen the Milky Way? And today, I would say, if I have an audience of 1,000 people, maybe 5 people out of 1,000 have ever taken the time to go, as you have, to the SAN, with the SAN, Namibia, elsewhere, and just to simply be still, quiet in our minds, quiet in our neurophysiological processes, and to absorb this incredible wonder. You know, the news can pull one down so much. Whenever you switch on the news, it's distressing, it's alarming, it causes fear and often causes trauma and may even cause panic. Whereas the cosmos that which I study, these billions of galaxies, fills me with this quietness that you describe. You know, what you describe in with the sand is what I can experience almost on a daily basis, because I have these images coming in from the James Webb Space Telescope onto my computer screens, and it causes one to have a harmony in one's mind, to be filled with this degree of stillness and wonder in a world, you know, Kate, of so much addiction. You know, since you last interviewed me, there's the appearance of AI on the scene, artificial intelligence, and that's causing yet more addiction to computers, much more addiction to computers.
Well, I must tell you, David, you'll be very pleased. Every single night, I live in the middle of Johannesburg, I go out last thing at night before I go to bed to look at the sky. And even in Johannesburg, the sky, especially at the moment because the weather's so good and so clear, I look at the stars, I find the Southern Cross, I find a couple of the galaxies I know, I look at Venus and love it. Just like you say, it's the perfect end to however rotten a day you've had. It's a perfect end to the day. And coming back to your James Webb Space Telescope, there's an excellent documentary on Netflix at the moment called Unknown. I don't know if you've seen it.
And I haven't seen it.
Oh, do. It really is James Webb for the lay person. And it's exciting, and it keeps you on the edge of your seat. And they make the point, I mean, human beings have put a camera 1,000,000 miles into space. And they make the point, David, and I know you would like this point. If humans, 10,000 humans could do that, what could humankind not achieve if we all...
I love that thought. It's not a big team, and just look what they achieved. But you know, Kate, the point is there was unity of purpose.
Exactly.
There was a commitment. There was unity of purpose, and with James Webb, there was a huge commitment, a focus on grandeur and success and splendor and reaching the goal. And that is so rare in the world today. But you know, I have next to me, I found this. I asked Mr. Mandela years ago, Kate, what his thoughts were on astronomy. Because of course he spent all this time on Robben Island, and very, very few people, very few would know this quote. I will show it to you. It's actually here in gold plated. But I want to read it. He says, and I quote, "One of the striking features of modern times is the emergence of men and women who have chosen the entire world as the theater of their operations. We are the beneficiaries of this inspiring phenomenon." quote unquote, Nelson Mandela, the 9th of April, 1998. And I just, this is what you were saying, Kate, about the James Webb. Mr. Mandela speaks about astronomy as making the entire world the theater of our operations. And if only more people could make the entire world the theater of their operations in a harmonious way, what a better, what a richer, and what a more glorious life you and I could lead.
Now tell us about, you talked a bit earlier, I love that astronomical gynecology, the birthing of stars. Explain to me, explain to us, how is a star born?
Yes, with absolute pleasure. So the closest star to the planet Earth is, of course, our sun. The temperature is around 16 million degrees centigrade. It's extraordinary at its center. But stars are born out of giant molecular clouds, giant clouds of gas, essentially, gas mixed with dust, cosmic dust. And these clouds collapse under gravity. So you think of a balloon, and you deflate the balloon, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, as the atoms in the giant molecular cloud, as the atoms start getting closer and closer together, the temperature starts rising, and the temperature can rise so much as the cloud of gas collapses that what happens is there's a process called thermonuclear fusion happens, where hydrogen starts fusing into helium gas. And that, in a nutshell, is how a star is born. So stars are really born out of huge clouds of gas and dust collapsing inward under gravity, collapsing, collapsing, collapsing. And when stars are born, for example, in the Pleiades star cluster, we see blue stars. Those are very, very hot, young blue stars. In fact, Kate, it's very interesting that the color of a star really is a secret to its temperature. Blue stars are very young and very hot, whereas our sun is like middle-aged and is like orange-reddish. So you can actually start probing the ages of stars by means of their colors, which is quite extraordinary.
So somewhere like Mars, our red planet, would them being older planets.
So what I'm talking about here, Kate, are stars.
Oh, stars, only. Not planets. Sorry, yeah.
Not planets.
Okay.
Mars is a different kettle of fish in that Mars is a planet, and on Mars it's got to do with ferrous oxide. Iron is combined with oxygen on the Martian surface to give you that very beautiful red characteristic hue. But what I'm talking here about are stars, the grandeur of stars, and it's stars. You see, the difference, which your high FM listeners might like to know, the difference between a star and a planet, which many people ask me, is this. Stars radiate light, whereas planets reflect light. The Earth reflects sunlight. It doesn't have its own internal power source, whereas our sun, for example, radiates light. Atoms of hydrogen are fusing into helium. Einstein's famous law equals MC squared kicks in, and it radiates. The sun radiates light. Whereas planets don't radiate light, they reflect light. So when I look at Mars and I see the red color, that's a planet reflecting sunlight. Sunlight, photons are traveling from the sun to the planet Mars, striking my eyes, giving the red color and so forth, telling me there's lots of ferrous oxide on the planet Mars. But with stars, it's a totally different kettle of fish, and I'm very glad you raised this, because it's a very important point, is that stars radiate light, and that's a very important point in astronomy. But now, not only are stars being born, but what the James Webb Space Telescope has helped us understand in a very new and beautiful way is that the whole universe went through a birthing process. We call this the Big Bang. It happened about 13.8 to 14 billion years ago. It's incredible. But I think it's incredible that you've got this early stage where the universe is actually being born, and astronomers through the eyes of the James Webb Space Telescope and other telescopes, Kate, can actually enjoy this cosmological or stellar gynecology. We can actually observe not only the birth of one star, not only the birth of a dozen stars, but the birth of the entire universe, which hosts billions upon billions of galaxies. And we can actually, you know, I have a friend, a dear friend, Kate. He's in his 90s now. I think he's 90 or 93 or somewhere around, Professor Giovanni Fazio at Harvard. And he's been sending me the most incredible images of the birthing of the universe through the eyes of the James Webb Space Telescope. And I think it is absolutely extraordinary, coming back to your earlier team, that a point that a relatively small team in the United States principally could come together and design something which is so constructive. And that's what I love about astronomy, you know, Kate. We do things which are constructive. And the James Webb Space Telescope, the images of the birthing of the universe you've seen on Netflix, as you say, they are absolutely mind-blowing. They even now, you know, Kate, it takes my breath away. It's like the late Philip Tobias, I suppose, coming across a new little anatomical feature at the Sterkfontein Caves. I think my excitement might parallel his in a very real sense in our different worlds. But these are extraordinary thoughts that our universe had a beginning, both in space and in time, 14 billion years ago. And that's very interesting. I mean, as I'm talking to you, everyone's aware of time and clocks tick. But, you know, people often just pop this question to me, Kate. What was God doing before he made the Big Bang? That question doesn't make sense, and I'll tell you why. Time only comes into existence at the Big Bang. There's no time before the Big Bang. So it doesn't make sense to ask what was God doing before he made the Big Bang, because there was no before, because there was no time. The only reason you can say, well, a few years ago or whatever, you were sitting with the sand in Namibia, is because there was the linearity of time. But outside of the universe, there's no time. It's that to me, you know, these are questions which Professor Stephen Hawking, yeah, whom I met in 2008, I accompanied him to meet Mr. Mandela. These are thoughts which have occupied his mind and the greatest of minds, but he dealt with this theoretically. He dealt with this theoretically, the birthing of the Big Bang universe and the singularity and so forth. The James Webb now is confirming that there was a beginning to our awesome universe.
Okay, so there was no time before we began.
Correct.
When we finish, after we finish, when our planet finally dies, for whatever reason, there'll be no time again.
Well, that is right, Kate. For example, if the universe ceased to exist, and suppose it reeks, you've got our expanding Big Bang universe, but suppose it actually were to collapse and so on. Time comes into existence. It's very important. At the Big Bang, there is no before the Big Bang because there is no time. Time is a material construct, if you like. We use time. You know, I traveled, you love traveling, of course, Kate, and I traveled many, many years ago to the land of Papua New Guinea. Oh, yeah. Now, these are people who've never seen a watch. They've never, ever seen a watch. And I said to them via the interpreters, can you tell me, how do you delineate time? What is time? And the interesting thing they tried to convey to me is they didn't understand what the watch was, but what they could understand is that time was like a spatial concept. It was a concept of when is the moon rising? When will we see Mars? When will the moon rise? It was based on the glorious cosmos in which we lived. And inextricably bound up in the cosmos was the understanding of time, but not in the sense that you and I understand time, really the movement as delineated by the planets and the stars and the galaxies and so forth. And I found that terribly interesting, you know. I mean, I saw, for example, a little treehouse, and I thought to myself, how does an inhabitant living in a treehouse understand time? I mean, how do they understand Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? They don't. What they appreciate is the now. They only live in the present. They're always living in the present. And that's exactly the way the San, I'm sure, as you know, Kate, also live. They live for the moment. And that's another great life lesson, you know, is to live for the moment and not to live in the past, as many, many people do, or not to worry too much about the future.
I couldn't agree more. It's my personal philosophy. It always has been. And I know you give lectures and you have presentations on time. I'm fascinated by time, and in my kind of life as a writer, broadcast and author, my inventory is time. Yes. Actually, and for many of us alive today, our inventory is time. We measure the time we work. Yes. We measure the time we eat. And it's awful to do that, actually, because we become prisoners of time.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's why I enjoy astronomy so much, because, you know, we are prisoners of time. And somehow, by traveling to Papua New Guinea, you sort of escape the cage of time. And I think that's what we're talking about here when we're in the deserts looking up at the Milky Way, for example, is you escape the prison of time. And to me, then you start living in the moment. You start living in the actual silence of the moment. And to me, those are irreplaceable qualities which no money can buy.
And just finally, I mean, could talk to you forever and ever, David, but I know, I mean, the program is called Travels with Kate. We've been traveling with you today in space. But I know you do take trips off up into the Arctic Circle, not yes. only to see the Northern Lights, but just to talk about the stars. Tell us about those.
Oh, yes, Kate. You know, this coming year, 2024, I have nearly 60 people, 60, coming with me. I want to say this as an astronomer. One of my greatest joys is to have people stand in the Arctic and look up and see the dancing northern lights. They are one of nature's grandest, most beautiful spectacles. And I'll never forget, I went with a group of around 30 gynecologists. They had gathered together and asked that I give the lectures, perhaps because of my connection with stellar gynecology. Anyway, when these gynecologists stood and they looked up and they just saw the aurora dancing across the night skies, they just said, each one, wow, wow. Wow. The Northern Lights, I think, is one of nature's grandest spectacles. We can see them very easily, not in the Antarctic, because, of course, there's no real land mass to have hotels in the Antarctic. But I'm traveling next year to the Arctic. That one's full. But if people are interested to book my Aurora tours for 2025, they're most welcome.
So you go up. The coast of Norway, and that's the way I do
yes,
it,
you know, Kate,
into the
you
Arctic
go up,
Circle.
Right up, you know, well through 66 and a half degrees parallel, sometimes 70 degrees parallel. The temperatures, even though, you know, they dive to minus 15, somewhere around there, minus 20, not one of my participants have ever felt cold. Because one thing Norwegians know how to do well is how to dress properly. And as you know, if you've got the correct thermal clothes, you were in the Karoo recently, if you've got the correct thermal clothes and hats and buffs. But one of my greatest joys, Kate, apart from communicating like I am to you, one of my greatest joys is, you know, writing of books and some communicating via lectures, but also taking people on these live tours and to see the excitement in their faces For me, I give a couple of lectures, of course,
yes,
during the Aurora tours. I give many talks on how to photograph the Aurora, what are the Aurora, and then many other talks like interpreting the, how do we interpret the latest images from space, from the James Webb Space Telescope. I've got a fascinating lecture on time. What is time? Why are we here? Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? So people also find their neurons intellectually quite...
And David, just give us your... It's just David, your website. It's David...
So my website is very easy if they want to book. It's just davidblock.co.za.
Okay. I don't know how, I want to try and get this question in before we finish. Very quickly. Of course there's life on other planets, isn't there?
Kate, there may be primitive life forms, but I still almost categorically say that there's no Kate Turkington, elsewhere. I still believe that most sincerely. Yes, I'm aware of dozens and more of exoplanets, but you know, the Earth is so beautifully and finely tuned. It's in its orbit around the solar system, and the sun, for example, if the sun were any hotter, we wouldn't be here. If the sun were any cooler, we wouldn't be here. If the Earth were any closer to the sun, we would fry. If it were any further, we'd freeze. So I'm very much aware that the universe, this is what I often taught my students, the universe has to be as large as it is just to support us and our life on terra firma. That's an incredible thought. People often say to me, David, but the universe is so vast. And I say, yes, the universe is so vast because if it were any smaller, we wouldn't be here. So while there's a great fuss about, you know, the possibility of aliens and ETI, there might be very primitive life forms elsewhere in the cosmos, but I don't believe in the wonders of the human being, such as us today and such as all of our listeners, as actually being, you know, as actually being all part of a large civilization which is simply buzzing throughout the cosmos. I simply don't accept that at all.
Okay. Oh, David, we could all listen to you forever and ever and ever. That's so good to see you today.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
Oh, the wonderful, irrepressible Professor David Block. And I thought later on in the year, maybe when it's coming up to Christmas, we might talk about the Star of Bethlehem and about alien life too, and about all kinds of things he can talk about. That whole presentation he gives on time is such a fascinating one. Now, I'm often asked, because now it's that time in the program, Travels with Kate, when I talk about books, and I'm often asked what are my favorite travel books. And I jotted down just five. Look, I read a lot. It's a gene I was born with. Some of my children have it. Some of my grandchildren have it. Some don't. I can read a book in a night, which is a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because it's wonderful and there's so many books to read. It's a curse because it gets very expensive if you read a book a night. I found an author I hadn't read this last week, and I thought, oh, do you know what? Because I'm going away, I'll just get some of her backlist on Kindle. So I blissfully ordered three of her books on Kindle, got my bill, and found I've spent a thousand rand. Books are expensive, but then they never go to waste because they go to family, they go to friends, go everywhere. So here are five of my favorite travel books, not in any order of preference. And you might be surprised to hear that one is The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, the children's book, primarily a children's book. But it's a book, it's a story that's never, ever lost its universal appeal. It was first published in 1908. And, of course, it's the story of Ratty and Mole and Toad. But it's not just their story. It's a story of adventure. It's a story of following unknown paths, going to unknown destinations, making new friends, having new experiences. And isn't that what travel is all about? And I discovered, a bit like Mole does in Wind in the Willows, I discovered, in fact, that my favourite place is home, Wind in the Willows. Another book that took us all by storm in the late 1980s, The Songlines by Bruce Chatwin. He became famous overnight, and so many travel books have since tried to copy his style or been influenced by him. It was a dazzlingly original book when it was first published. In fact, it transformed the face of travel writing, The Songlines by Bruce Chatwin. What happened? Bruce Chatwin went deep into the Australian outback, and he followed the lives and the philosophy of one of the world's oldest peoples, the Aborigines. They're one of the old, in fact, I may be right in saying they're the oldest people on Earth, whose lives were starkly different from present-day cultures. Our obsession with status and material things. Aboriginal people, okay, maybe now because of social engineering, because of the way the world turns, many, many have changed. But I've visited Alice Springs and I've visited the Outback and I've been lucky enough to stay with a couple of Aboriginal communities, proper ones, in the red heart of Australia. And going back to what David Block was saying, time doesn't exist. Time only is now. Time is the moment I'm talking to you. It's not what you're going to do in 20 minutes. It's not what you did when you wake up this morning. It's now, 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 now. That's a wonderful book. If you haven't read it, The Songlines by Bruce Chatwin. And any of Bill Bryson's books. I'm sure many of you have read many of Bill Bryson's books, whether it was his first one, Notes from a Small Island about the UK. Side-splittingly funny. You laugh. Or there was his Walk in the Woods when he went into America's Appalachian Trail. And his recent books have been Journeys into the Body, is the latest one, The Body. He actually travels into our bodies and tells us what we find there. And written with such wit and style and humour. Will keep you. I love Bill Bryson. I've always got a Bill Bryson by my bed among my pile of books there. And then, of course, Paul Theroux. I've interviewed Paul Theroux several times, actually. His first great travel book was The Great Railway Bazaar. Wonderful, wonderful book. It's an astonishing account of his train journeys throughout India. And I mean, he didn't go first class, or he went with a backpack as a young man. He sat with the peasants, he sat with everybody, he travelled everywhere. Really worth reading, and you can reread it, called The Great Railway Bazaar by Paul Theroux. And any of Paul Theroux's books actually are fascinating reading, but that's the one he made his name with, and for my money, is still the best of the lot. And then one I've just finished, and I've already got a waiting list from my family and friends, is from the American author Ann Patchett. If you're a reader, you'll know her name. She's won so many prizes for her writing, and she writes so beautifully. It's called Tom Lake. That's not the name of a person, actually. It is actually the name of a lake, Tom Lake. And it's about a mother and her three daughters during lockdown. And they've come home to a cherry orchard. There's sort of shades of the cherry orchard, Chekhov's play here. And they find out that when she was young, their mother had an affair with one of Hollywood's most famous actors. Mum, you didn't have an affair with so-and-so. Yes, I did. Well, tell us. And she spins the story out of her affair with one of the world's fictional most famous authors. And she does it so cleverly because she tells them some of the truth and some of the stuff she keeps just for herself and we, the readers. Absolutely wonderful book. I didn't want to end it. You know, when you're reading a book and you don't want it to finish, that's how I felt with this one. Tom Lake by Anne Patchett. You'll find it in all the good bookshops at the moment. Should be there in the front row. Bloomsbury Publishers. Alas, there's so much rubbish often in the front row of booksellers. But this is a beautiful book. Beautifully written, a wonderful story, not chick lit, and you won't put it down. And as I say, she's won so many awards for her writing. Well, that's all for today. We've travelled through space, we've travelled through southwestern India, we've travelled to several places with authors, and now time to say goodbye. So thank you all for listening. Be good. Lots of love, lots of life. Look after yourselves and, of course, always look after others too.